Welcome to the Success Leaves Clues podcast with Robin Bailey and Al McDonald. Have you ever wondered what makes someone successful? What are they doing that's different? How do they achieve greatness? We believe that success leaves clues. In this series, we are interviewing very successful people from different walks of life to hear their stories. We'd like to remind our listeners that the views expressed in this podcast are those of our guests and not necessarily those shared by our hosts.
Welcome back to the Success Leaves Clues podcast. Today's episode is sponsored by Life and Legacy Advisory Group. Discover our commitment to our clients. At Life and Legacy, building wealth, securing your family's future, giving back, and creating a lasting legacy are not just values, but a way of life. Let us guide you toward a future aligned with what matters most to you. We're also brought to you by Aria Benefits. If you're a business leader challenged with talent attraction, employee engagement, or supporting your mental health, we can help. Use your benefits package as the key to unlock your workforce. I'm your host, Robin Bailey, back at it again on Podcast Friday with my amazing co-host, Al McDonald. Al, what are you saying these days?
Well, thanks, Robin. As always, looking forward to our guest today and hearing his story. And I'll add in a shameless plug for my upcoming cycle challenge in August, where once again, I will be on my bike. I've committed to another 750K this year for the month of August, raising money for sick kids, for kids with cancer. So there's my first shameless plug. Anyone that wants to help support that cause, please, by all means, do so. And we really appreciate it. But yeah, let's jump into our podcast. Looking forward to speaking with our guest today.
Well, it's a great ride. Al's done it a few years in a row now, and it'll be across all our social channels. So it's a great cause. We have a great time with it. And we've been very fortunate with a lot of people supporting him in the past. So yes, keep an eye out for that. I have to give a shout out before we start to our good friend, Rich Appiah. And by the time this episode airs, Rich Appiah will, I haven't told anybody, but Rich Appiah is who I chose to have on the podcast again for episode 200. And it's a very powerful episode. And Rich has just been such a great friend and great connector. So we have to give him a shout out. And he gave us the introduction to Russell McLeod, who is the founder at Mighty Hum. Mighty Hum is a small but mighty team of social entrepreneurs and experienced advisors on a mission to build simple, sustainable, and creative solutions for your biggest business challenges. Russ, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me here.
Well, Russ, as I said, Rich Appiah gave us the introduction. And when Rich reaches out and says, you got to meet this person, I pay attention because he's done it a few times in the past, including your brother, by the way.
Yes.
That we talked to him. And we've had such a good friendship with him as well. The first time I met you, I had called you from the car because I knew I had at least an hour on the car ride. And I thought, well, I can make a couple of calls. You and I ended up talking for at least 45 minutes that day.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
Yeah. And I enjoyed that conversation. I felt chemistry between us immediately, which is what we call those initial calls to make sure, you know, we can actually do a podcast together. And I enjoyed that conversation so thoroughly. I had called Al and I said, you are going to love this person, because obviously we couldn't hop on a call together that day. I was hoping that you could kind of recreate that conversation and just tell us about your career journey, because I was fascinated with what you've done up until this point. So maybe you could just recreate that for us.
Absolutely. So where to start? So I actually grew up in Northern BC in a town called Prince George. We are about a 10-hour drive north of Vancouver, which you would think is that would feel like it would be right pressed up against the Yukon, but it's actually geographically the very center of BC. So I grew up there, which I really enjoyed, and I played a ton of sports. My whole family did. So my dad coached my basketball team, but he also coached my sister's basketball team and my brother's basketball team. And so I think in 1 year through the 12 months, we counted that he coached five of our kids' basketball teams. It was really quite something. And I loved that, but it taught me a lot. It actually set me on my path, because the thing that I loved most about playing sports was the team aspect of it. And that is what led me to take on business, is because, you know, as I was heading out to university, I was trying to figure out what the right thing was to take on. And, you know, as a team, when you start off a season, sometimes you really suck as a bunch of individuals playing together. And I remember, I think it was my grade 10 year, our very first tournament, we finished last place. And then we just spent the whole year learning how to play together. And by the end of the year, we finished first in our district, in our region. And it wasn't because of any individual reason. It was actually the experience of learning how to play together. And so business seemed to be the closest thing to that path. And so I ended up heading in that direction, landed at the University of Ottawa, and just really enjoyed the concepts of business. But the culture of the experience wasn't perfectly aligning for me. Now, I did end up becoming a teaching assistant. Well, at the University of Ottawa, a professor tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Would you ever consider doing something like this?" And I had stopped playing sports, which at the time had been my whole identity growing up. And I started to head down this whole other path of what it meant to be involved in academics, which was totally different. But something that occurred for me is that three of the students in the first semester that I taught came back at the end of the semester and said, "Listen, I was having a really hard time in my first year, and you made a big positive impact on me, helping me out in helping to navigate my life in a new place." And it was just a realization that I could make a positive difference in somebody's life. And that just kind of set off a light or a bell went off. And I was like, oh, this is something that I want to do. And so when I got to my fourth year of university, I reached out to a friend who was working for a charity called Free the Children. And I said, "Could you just list off for me the five charities that you think I should consider working for? Because I think what I want to do is go work for a charity for a year or maybe two, and then I'll go head off into the business world." And she said, "No, just come to Toronto and come work for us." She said, "I'm not going to give you a list of groups to consider." And so I took a break, like spring break. I traveled from Ottawa down to Toronto, and I met this organization called Free the Children at the time. And it was the most fascinating experience to show up. So the organization was mainly run. So it was founded by two brothers, Mark and Craig Kielberger, and it was running out of their parents' house. And the parents had moved out of the house. I think they were renting a condo around the corner. I can't quite recall. But the house was filled with boxes for medical kits. And everybody who I met working there was probably under the age of 30, but just incredible human beings. And there was about 12 full-time employees and probably 10 other volunteers. And it just had this really gritty feel. So a lot of people were actually living in the house, but desks were set up in the living room. And then there was another little office around the corner. So as much as it was gritty like that, they also were running a campaign with the Canadian government. They were working with the UN on something. And then Oprah was funding 500 schools through the organization. And it just seemed like this opportunity to get into the ground floor of something special. And so I joined Free the Children at the time. And I did a few really fun projects along the way. So I helped, the brothers were launching a book called Me to We at the time. And the book is based on this philosophy of you can find meaning and purpose in life by focusing less on yourself and more towards reaching out and helping others. And so I was the very first business graduate ever hired by the organization. Also the very first person to ever show up to the first day of work in a suit, which people pointed and laughed at me and we had a good chuckle. I still have a picture of it somewhere. So that book, that concept, because I was the only business graduate they had ever hired, I got earmarked to lead the marketing on it. And it was only like 8 years later that I understood that they thought that I had a marketing degree, but I actually took operations management and management information systems. So like I was trained in the back end of things, not in the front end of things, but I got earmarked to lead the marketing of that book. And we did two versions of it, one for Canada, one in the US. And we eventually took it to New York Times bestsellers list. And the book really resonated with people because it really struck a chord. And if anybody has spent time volunteering in their life, they truly understand what that experience is like because, you know, you expect to go to help somebody else. When you finish the experience, you actually feel like you're the one who's received a tremendous amount of help and support. And you certainly feel a sense of meaning through that experience. So I had an opportunity to run the marketing of that book. And we had some great success with it. We then partnered with Canadian Living and this amazing woman, Susan Antonacci from Canadian Living magazine. And we launched the Me to We Awards, which we ran for years, highlighting everyday Canadians taking on amazing actions. And then eventually I got tasked with, because the philosophy Me to We was taking off, I got tasked with a very audacious task which can only be provided when you're young and you have that young ignorance. But I was tasked with starting a social movement. So how do we actually take this philosophy and build it into something larger? So we would grow by going to schools where we would give speeches talking about different social issues that young people can get involved in. And at the end of a speech, 30 or 40 kids would stay to talk to the speaker. But the two or three kids that would wait till the end so they could get the most time with the speakers were from the social justice clubs at the school. And they would say, listen, I've been in the social justice club for years. I cannot convince my friends to participate in our campaigns. Like, caring is not cool. So we would see this. It would show up at every school that we would go and do speeches at. And so we eventually came up with this concept of, well, why don't we bring all of these super passionate but slightly depressed young people together in one huge venue, and we'll bring in some of the world's biggest musicians and artists, and we'll inspire them to believe that they're not alone in their fight to change the world. And so that led to the creation of an event called We Day. So I led the creation of it and I ran it for 5 years. And We Days initially were very humble. So like the first one was in 2007. If you think back to that time, the biggest celebrities who were socially conscious were Bono, Madonna, Angelina Jolie, and Brad Pitt together as a couple. So we thought, oh, for sure, they're going to want to participate in this. So we're sending out letters to all these celebrities and no replies back. But we did end up with an incredible group of speakers. They just weren't the biggest celebrities in the world, but we had incredible people like Jesse Cruikshank, who was a host at MTV and is now doing incredible things. The cast of Degrassi, I think, I'm not sure if it was the very first event, but Nina Dobrev was a part of the cast of Degrassi and she was at a We Day. We had Hanson, you remember Umbop? Yeah, but like 10 years after Umbop was big, they're still some of the most authentic, incredible musicians I ever met. But this first event was, we pulled it together. Every person in the organization had to have their regular job and then they had their We Day job. So you might be somebody who coordinates with schools, but you're also responsible for overseeing parking for 7,000 people at the Rico Coliseum. And somebody else was booking speeches and they were also responsible for all of our VIP experiences at the event. So it was this really organic experience pulling it all together. And that first event was the most special thing ever. We were a half an hour late in opening the doors. So when we finally got them open, kids were running to their seats from standing at the stage. It looked like a virus was taking over the stadium, just filling up, streaming in everywhere. Before the event started, one side of the stadium started chants to the other side and security pulled me aside and said, like, this is crazy. Do we need to shut down the venue? Of course we didn't. It was just the passion of it all. Every speaker received at least one standing ovation. Some received two. And at the same time, when they were talking, you could hear a pin drop. Everybody was just sitting on their edge of the seats. And I recall Suzanne Boyce, who at the time was the president of CTV. She had committed to MTV taking the event and turning it into a half an hour TV special. And MTV was brand new to Canada at the time. I'm sure it was the smallest channel within the CTV family. She got a chance to go on stage and welcome the kids. And she came off and she pulled me aside and said, you know, the energy is just unreal. The event was happening on a Friday. I'm going to have the team cut a promo for Monday. And, you know, she's talking to me while I'm running my first major event. So I'm just, Suzanne, thank you so much. Well, I'm freaking out going like, I need to go back and figure out how to run this event. But anyways, what she made the team do is they worked the whole weekend and they cut a half an hour special from the Friday to the Monday. And then instead of being on MTV, she canceled Young and the Restless on CTV, and we were played on CTV mainnet. So we went from the smallest channel to the largest channel. And then I believe she ended up playing the special 56 more times on 8 different CTV channels. So anytime that they didn't have proper programming in place, she would plug into that spot and put the event coverage in. And so that day in particular, when you left that event, you just felt like this was the epicenter of the drop happening in water and the waves of a movement of positivity were heading out into the world, that these young people were so dedicated to taking positive actions in a really incredible way. So it's one of my career highlights is just that experience. And I loved running We Days for 5 years. The thing that I love most about it is the impact that it had on the culture of the Canadian education system. So I told you, you know, only two or three kids from social justice clubs. Well, teachers who were running these programs for years, 5, 7 years into We Days, would write us and say, you know, like, I've got 75 kids who signed up for the social justice club. Can we get more tickets to We Day? So we saw that really positive change happen, and very proud that we got to play a part in that. And then at that point, I shifted from running the events over to the social enterprise arm. And it was mainly travel division at that time and some leadership work. And I want to say we're about $7 million in revenue, probably. And over 10 years, we grew it to $42 million in revenue. We launched a retail side of the organization that allowed us to employ 1,400 women in rural Kenya. We were able to pay those women 2.2 times what was considered a fair wage for the region. A decade later, I got to travel back and see the impact on the community, and it was incredible. So the charity had been doing financial literacy training with the women, and then we were providing employment and income. And, you know, driving in this rural area, the Maasai Mara, I see this big building off in the distance, and I think, oh, the charity must have built that. And the driver explained to me, no, the women have pooled their money. They've been buying cattle with the extra income that they've been generating, and they've built a co-op that distributes milk to the largest milk distributor in Kenya, who travels all the way out to this remote area once a week and picks up milk from their cows. And it was just that little bit of entrepreneurship you just saw scattered all through the community. There's a college that the charity built, and a few women, I think, pooled their money and built a small 6-room hotel so parents could come and visit their children while at school. So really cool little pieces of impact that you see come through the work there. But ultimately, as my time wrapped up at MeToWe, I shifted into doing some fractional work, and that ultimately led to the building of Mighty Hub. And so we're an organization that supports growing organizations, just in general, businesses, but it's not a requirement. We have a deep passion for collaborating with purpose-driven businesses. And so we specialize in providing consulting services, and we also help founders and CEOs take on really hairy, audacious ideas and turn them into actionable ventures and strategic plans that can really come to life. So it's been a really incredible career journey.
Wow.
You did a great job there, because that is exactly the conversation that we had while I was driving in the DVP that day. And I think, Al, you see why I phoned you and said you're going to really enjoy meeting Russ. Russ, you said something in the very beginning that struck me, and I was thinking about it just from even our own business perspective. And I thought it was a really unique way in 200 episodes. I've never heard anyone frame it this way, but you're talking about your basketball team and you were terrible and you're in last place.
Yeah.
And you had to learn to play together.
Yes.
And then you intimated that you've brought that over to the business world as well.
Yes.
Can you talk to us about times where you've seen that either work really well and you joined somewhere where you were able to learn and play together? But on the other side, is have you ever faced a situation where you were in an organization where it didn't work?
Yeah, absolutely. So listen, running a business is like a growing organism. Like a business is a growing organism. It is not a static thing. You bring together a whole bunch of humans and you try really hard to align them to a clear mission and vision of an organization and move in unison in one direction. And what's true about humans is they are the greatest tool in the world, like the most powerful, intelligent, incredible tool in the world. And they can also be the most disruptive, toxic tools that we have too. So you can either align them incredibly well and you get that multiplier feeling, that multiplier effect. But if things are not going well, it's, you know, one of those most disruptive, destructive forces that can exist. And so I can go back to some of my We Day days. One of the things that we used to do to really plan out is that we had team leads for all the different things happening in the stadium. So I mentioned somebody would oversee seating, somebody would oversee food, our parking, our honored guests experiences, all of those types of things would be led by different people. But one of the things that we always required them to do is to come up with their top 10 ended up really being their top five ways that things would go wrong on Avente. And then they had to walk us through how they would work through those plans. And then in our lead-in day, often we would ask them to mimic those problems so they could see what it would be like in the venue and prepare for that. The first year that we went to Vancouver, we hosted the Dalai Lama at a We Day. The Dalai Lama was actually the reason why we went to Vancouver to put on a We Day. So he was coming to Canada. He required a youth event to be done as a part of the set of events that he does. The person who ran the Dalai Lama Center had come to a previous We Day and asked us if we would do it. We said yes, as long as it could be a We Day. And so as we prepared for that event, you know, we originally had, I think, 28 minutes of the Dalai Lama's time. But as he became more in demand with the other events, it kept shrinking in the lead up to the events. It was 28 minutes, and then it was 22, and then it was 17. And then at some point, it was like down to 12. And so we had put in place all of these plans to prepare for the Dalai Lama not showing up. So like, what is the script that you tell the host to go say to all of these kids and teachers who came largely to see the Dalai Lama? And so we were prepared for all of these different aspects of what that would mean. In the morning, in the lead up to the event, well, actually the event had started, the Dalai Lama had gone through his agenda for the day with his handler. And when he heard We Day, he'd said, you know, like, is that the youth event? And they said, yeah. And he said, oh, cancel my event before. I want to go spend more time with the kids. And I know this because we had helped organize CTV to do a documentary of his time there. And the fellow who was doing that documentary was also a fellow who had done some documentaries with the organization going overseas and seeing things. So he told me this story afterwards. And so as the event is running, I get a text. Remember the old school Blackberries that had like the roller ball on the side? And so I got a text saying the DL wants to arrive 30 minutes early and extend his time on stage, and he'd like to have questions from youth. Have a great day. And I remember being, because I run the stage while this is happening and I'm backstage, and I remember getting this text and reading it. And I'm going, who's the DL? And then I realized, oh, it's the Dalai Lama. And that just set in motion a tremendous set of changes. And so we brought our core team together, and we had somebody who led issues. And then we had our script person, our talent person. And, you know, we had to move, I think it was 13 line items in the layout of the event to get that organized. And keep in mind, he was coming at, I want to say, planned at 10:30, was now going to arrive at like 10:10. And this is like 9:30, 9:45 in the morning. And so we hadn't planned for questions on stage. So we had our script person rewrite the script going in, but then prep possible questions that kids could ask. We sent another person up to go run and find the kids who we'd planned to actually sit on stage, but we didn't actually seat them all together when they weren't on stage. So they were running all over the place. We had to let certain talent know that their time on stage was changing and the order had to shift. But it just ran so smoothly. So if you were sitting in the audience, you had no clue that it was just mayhem backstage to make that happen. It's actually why we named it the organization Mighty Hum, because it's that feeling of the experience of when you have your team humming and what that's like. Now, I've also been in situations where that hasn't worked, right? We had a sales division at MeetAwe that something was wrong in the product structure and the pricing, and those things not lining up resulted in the salespeople feeling a lot of the pressure of not being able to sell well. And that really affected culture. You have high turnover happening when that's existing. You have salespeople who are spending time with unqualified leads. So what does that actually feel like? Instead of maybe five no's to one yes, it feels like 15 no's to one yes, which is just deflating. So that's also a challenge. And it's not unusual for organizations to cycle through that. So you have these natural growth curves that exist in an organization where your current structure and your operations work for the size that you're at. And you grow through that because it's working really well. And then you get to a size where all of a sudden those start to break. And it's very natural. And then you go through these stages that as it breaks, how quickly can you recognize it? What can you do to fix it. But sometimes you have to live through the pain of high turnover, of the wrong manager in the wrong position, the wrong skill sets on the team, like all these things that you have to deal with to figure out how you're going to grow through that stage next. So it's also not fun, but that's just a part of it being that living organism of humans and figuring out how to make that work.
It's interesting that you use that term living organism, because you're actually the second person today to describe a business in that very manner. So it's interesting to hear different people talk about the same thing. I do have a question. Earlier, you said that you work with a lot of companies, ideally, that are purpose-driven.
Yes.
And that's a phrase that's thrown out there. You hear it a little bit more and more, and maybe it's popular, whatever. What do you mean by purpose-driven? What do you look for? What makes an organization purpose-driven in your mind? And why would a company want to be purpose-driven?
Often it's because they're founded with some form of social impact in their mission in some way. I'll give you an example. I've had a chance to work with a group called the Global Employment Challenge. They're part of a couple of organizations. Like, they're founded by the same fellow. It's almost program naming. But the other offering that he provides is called Talent Match. And he was a fellow who had originally built an organization to help international students find internships that could then lead to meaningful employment in the countries that they travel to get their education. But he met with the Nelson Mandela Foundation, and they challenged him to say, it is fantastic that you're doing that for international students. Africa has really focused on education of its young people, and more people are graduating than ever, but there aren't the jobs to support them. So they've been told this promise that if you get a university education, you'll be able to get a good paying job. And in reality, what's happening is that there's very high unemployment for young people. And so he challenged them, could you help address that issue? And so this fellow has added this whole other function to his business. His name is Gerard. And he's done a brilliant job, but he has a vision of providing 2 million jobs for Africans through offshore employment. So he's actually approaching organizations in North America to provide them employment opportunity that's cost effective, but in the model that is really transformative in the countries that he's providing it. So these people aren't working from home. He has an office set up for them. They have managers in place that do career development and extra training on it. They all have benefits, but he's enabling this whole generation to have access to employment. And it's got an awesome value proposition here in North America, which is we can provide you high quality work from highly experienced people at a lower price. So that would be an example of a purpose-driven organization.
So my follow-up question then would be, why is working with those types of companies important to you?
When I see the problems in the world, I actually think that business is uniquely positioned to potentially be the most important tool for solving them. Business is the backbone of our economy, but when done well, businesses are tremendously resilient. And especially when the impact problem that you're trying to solve is aligned with the customer problem that you're trying to solve, you can really drive substantive change. And as you can tell, business is a passion of mine. So bringing those two things together fills my soul, gives me a great sense of purpose. There's certainly a part of it that is selfish because it creates meaning for me.
Selfish is fine.
Yes.
Selfish is great. When you just said, as you said, that it creates purpose for you. Any success stories around some of the companies that you've worked with on a purpose-driven mission that you want to share?
There's one in particular that I'm working with out of Chicago that I'm super passionate about. It's a group called Lunum, L-U-N-U-M. And Lunum is focused on providing data for companies to help them better understand how their decisions are impacting their employees and their community. So they've partnered with Harvard and a group called the International Foundation for Valuing Impact. And they've utilized a methodology called impact accounting that was born out of Harvard. And impact accounting asks a series of basic questions that are done through calculations. But it's questions like, are we paying everybody in our organization above a living wage? Are we overpaying anybody in our organization? Are people being paid equally across demographics for the same work, same pay for same work? Are the demographics of our organization the same as the demographics of our local community? And so these are really good questions, and there's a few more that they go through, but they're really good questions to ask. And what they're doing is they're providing this as a tool for organizations to measure this in their supply chain. So when you see some of these large organizations who have come out with big commitments about how they are focused on diversity or how they support their employees, well, often they're also expecting that their supply chain follows those same values. And so this is an incredible tool that allows them to do that. And the other fascinating thing is she's been able to index the Russell 1000 to see what performance looks like. And so when you receive this information as an organization, you actually see yourself compared to your industry, which is super powerful because receiving the scores on your own is helpful, but seeing where you're lagging and where you're excelling are really important tools to emphasize where you should put effort, but also emphasize where you can speak about what you're doing within your employee value proposition. And so I started working with her when she was pre-revenue. She's now at a point where this year she'll probably clear $2 million in revenue. And so we've been able to move in that direction within 2 years. She's fostered some incredible partnerships. She's working with one of the largest soft serve companies in the United States. I can't tell you who it is because it hasn't been announced, but she's running it on a massive supply chain right now. And to see the positive reaction of suppliers, it's been phenomenal. There are real changes happening in their behavior. So as you could tell, it's one that I'm excited about.
Yeah, it's a great story.
I'm enjoying this conversation as much as I did the first time. And I'm actually learning more. And as you're chatting, I'm realizing that we're talking about a lot of the great stuff that happened in our careers.
Yeah.
But life is not, I wish it was. I wish life was all about just that smooth ride and all the ups and everything's positive. But we all know that's not the reality. Can you talk to us about any obstacles that you faced along the way?
Well, I think the biggest one for me has been the collapse of We, the organization We. So I was running the social enterprise while that was happening. I'd spent 16 years of my career. And for those of you who haven't read the press, there were a few key moments that occurred for the organization. So the first very, very difficult one was the pandemic. So on the social enterprise side, we worked in international travel and in retail, which meant that we worked in malls. And when I say we worked in international travel, we specialized in taking students to developing countries without their parents. So when you talk about a particular niche of travel that isn't resistant to international pandemics in general, that is one. So in December 2019, I'd gone through Ebola virus in Africa, and that was mainly on the West African side, and we were working on the East African side. But we saw a hit to our business of 10 to 15% of travelers that needed to move to new destinations with us or canceled their travel. And so I was forecasting, seeing the pandemic coming, okay, let's plan for maybe 10 or 15% off of our revenue that would be impacted. That was December. By March or April, I was forecasting that there wouldn't be meaningful revenue for the travel division for 3 to 5 years. So that alone was incredibly difficult because we built a high performing team within the organization. Many employees that had worked with me for a decade or more, and like A-plus players, incredible individuals. And then you're sitting across the table from them telling them that you have to let them go. I can't explain how warped that whole experience was to be going through that. It was just incredibly difficult. So then what had happened, so the charity also worked in large scale events, of course, as any charity, high income donors, and then working in schools. So you also think about three major category industries that were hugely impacted by the pandemic. All extracurricular activities at schools shut down for basically two and a half years. Large scale events, same thing, shut down. And then we also saw large donors freeze their money during that time as uncertainty was happening. So they also had large layoffs. And then coming through that, the federal government asked us if we would consider helping them run a program for students who couldn't find jobs in the summer because of the pandemic. And it was this very large, audacious program to try to provide employment to them. But we didn't find out till very late in the process that we were the single supplier asked to bid on it. So they didn't ask anybody else to bid. And the Trudeaus, Justin, his wife, his brother, and his mother had spoken at We Days. His mother and brother had been paid for some of the events that they had spoken at. And so this became a political storm focused on this idea that Trudeau was handing out this large contract to his best buddies, the Kilberger brothers. And so we just became fodder, became the We scandal. And it just resulted in press every day, not just on that topic, on any other topic that they could find related to the organization, and became a lambasting in a very public way. And, you know, what was so fascinating to go through that on a personal level was my personal legacy was tied to that. So like this belief that this is coming to an end, but also this belief that as I walk out into the world, will others view the work that I've done and believe that it was important, effective work. But then I also saw institutions that I had trust in that I just I lost trust in. I watched the media just on a frenzy, trying to find anything that they could talk about. And I've always viewed the media as like a group that is a really important group to provide critical views on issues. And I found at that point that I personally didn't feel like those were balanced views. I felt like that was trying to maximize as many clicks as possible. And then I watched politicians, which how ignorant am I to think that politicians would act with great integrity? But I saw politicians purposely misleading when they knew the right information, that even when the organization saw them misrepresenting something, would send them details of information so they could properly represent, and purposely choosing not to do that. But then like the last piece of all of this that was difficult, it was under the pressure of all of that, was also just like the breakdown of good relationships born through the organization and past employees who felt hurt by the organization at some point, seeing this as an opportunity to share their views. And so it was just, in its best of ways, it was, well, listen, there was no best of ways. It was toxic. I found myself walking around in my neighborhood, not wanting to make eye contact with my neighbors and feeling a sense of shame. But it also brought for me this view of what happens on the web is not what is happening in real life. Because the number of times that I read incredibly negative things about the work of the organization and the organization itself online, thousands. The number of times I was confronted in real life or people brought really critical views to me, very few. Almost everybody met me with empathy. Not to say that they agreed with everything, but it certainly wasn't what you were hearing online.
Russ, there is, and you've chatted about it very articulately, there were things going on well beyond your control with the charity. Did you ever find yourself worried about yourself in terms of that sticking to you as you ventured out into, you know, other opportunities for yourself? Did you feel people were going to have that judgment against you?
Absolutely. Yes. And it's one of the reasons why I initially started to do fractional work, because I had a strong enough network that there was a bunch of people who knew me and thought that they needed support. But at one point, I started to interview for jobs, and I especially felt a different sense of pressure with that. I've had a few situations where people have decided not to work with me because of doing some of the research on the history. But there are also many people who see it as an asset to have somebody who lived through that and the learnings that you gain from that, which has been a really important part of my story too. Like living through crisis management is a tremendous skill to have.
Yeah. And there's not many people that would be able to tell your story and go through what you've gone through and then come out the other side. And like you say, I'm sure you've grown from it. I'm sure you've learned from it. I'm sure you've brought some positive outcomes from it, even though it's probably as tough as it was at the time and still thinking back.
Yeah.
So let's focus on maybe something a little more positive. Tell me what success means to you.
I think success is about getting a chance to apply your skills in a way that challenges you and pushes you into growth and allows you to deliver outcomes that are meaningful for you. And if you're to really articulate, I think what that means is it's actually not the outcome, it's the journey, which is something that I think all of us learn as not in early adulthood, later adulthood. So I'm now in my mid-40s. And, you know, the world is a lot less black and white. We all live more in the gray area. But the journey and everything that we're doing is so important. But finding those opportunities where you can deliver value to others in that by using your skills is particularly feels like success.
Can you share maybe some examples of that? And, you know, one thing, we've had this discussion even amongst ourselves a little bit about success. And in the past, let's just say, or maybe even still, you know, success is quite often correlated with money, right?
Yeah.
If I'm wealthy, I'm successful. If I'm not, then I haven't been so successful. Talk about that a little bit. What are your thoughts?
So much of my work has brought me the opportunity to work with high-income individuals. A common thing that I've seen with individuals who've made lots of money in their career is they get to a point where they feel like it's finally time to do their legacy work. And a common thing that they talk about is how much they wish they would have found ways to do that earlier. That instead of this idea of, I'm going to build my money, when I've got a stack of it, then I'm going to do good, feels like it's held them void of some of the great joy they could have had in their life along the way. Because I've worked in a lot of purpose-driven organizations. And the common thing that when we have engaged some of those very experienced people is it either in the services provided by purpose-driven organizations or having mentors come in and work with us, is it's the ability to put their values into meaningful action. That is like a common thread. And I think when you can do that in your work along the way, it is really helpful to make money. There's nothing wrong with wealth generation. I think we should all strive for that. I think that's actually really important. But we also know that there is diminishing returns on that beyond a certain point. So kind of the goal in life is to make enough money that you don't need to think about money anymore, right? If you're stuck thinking about money, it is one of the worst stresses in your life. If you can get over that hurdle to the point where you're making enough money that you don't need to think about money, that it's really good to be thinking about the things that fill your soul.
I'm in the business, right? That's what we try and do for our clients. And you kind of hit on it too. You know, it's a little bit of the scarcity mindset versus the abundance mindset, right? And we quite often get trapped in this, hey, I need more versus what you just said about, hey, you know what? I've already got some of that. I could start to use that already. It's almost a mindset switch of thinking, oh, you already do have some. So let's do some good already.
Yeah. And do you see that, Al? You are actually working with that group who's in that wealth management stage.
I see much of what you just said, which is now that I've gotten to a certain point, now I want to give back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things we talk about is, well, maybe you just need to switch your mindset a little bit. Look at it. It's not a scarcity. Look at it as an abundance.
Yeah, very true.
Well, I think, you know, based on some of our conversation already, we could probably talk for hours and hours with Russ, but it is that time in the episode where Al's going to throw out his signature question, Russ, if you're up for it, because you've already talked about, to me, I've already heard a ton of things that you were doing, but maybe there's something else that you're going to add here. So Al, I'll let you take it away.
Yeah, it's always worth asking the question because people usually come up with something more that you haven't already talked about. So here we go. A society grows great when old persons plant trees in whose shade they will never sit. So can you talk about any of those proverbial trees that you might be planting?
There's one program that I've had the opportunity to help run, and it's in partnership with the YWCA in Chicago. They run a program called Breedlove. Breedlove is an accelerator program for women of color with revenues between $100,000 and $2 million. And these are, I call them Main Street businesses, meaning these aren't really crazy, innovative startups that are doing new things in pharma care. This is more like your nail salon. We had our first construction company in the last cohort, massage therapy. Like they're very traditional businesses that if you were to walk down a Main Street that you would see there. And it's been one of the most fulfilling programs that I've had a chance to participate in. But one of the core things that we've really been focusing on with these women, because something that I've learned through this program is how underfunded women are in business. So entrepreneurs, female entrepreneurs receive much less money, but specifically Black women receive much, much less money. But we've really been focused on how do you build a resilient, long-term successful business. And I've now had a chance to work with 50 to 60 entrepreneurs through this program. And we've really narrowed in on some of the most important things, because the other thing that I've learned about female entrepreneurs is that they put everybody first before themselves. So they put their employees first, they put their customers first, they put their community first. They're even putting their family first in this whole process. And often what we've seen in these early stage organizations is that they're not paying themselves a good wage and they're sacrificing on their profits. And so we've very much focused on what is the path to you paying yourself a good wage and to have 20% profitability. And the reason for that is if you get 20% profitability, then a bank will actually look at you and consider you for a loan to support your growth. Investors would consider you as an interesting investment. There's a whole bunch of reasons why it fosters that, but it's also about building wealth within that community. So now I'm 60 entrepreneurs in, and we're 3 years into the program, and I'm getting a chance to bump into some of these women again and hearing the stories of where they've taken their businesses and how they're growing and what they're doing. It's probably the greatest metaphor to your question in terms of a program that I've got a chance to operate. It literally is the planting of seeds, the type of support and the community that we can build around these women and what they're doing for their communities. It's amazing.
That is a great story. And I'm glad you shared that with us. So kudos to you for doing that. And yeah, I'm glad that you shared that with us, and best of luck in continuing with that support.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Well, Russ, thank you for joining us today, and thank you for sharing your journey. I mean, it's so interesting. I'm so glad we were able to do the podcast together. What's the best way for people to reach out to you if they have questions about yourself or what you're doing next at Mighty Hum?
The best way is come to mightyhum.com and you'll find us there. But if you want to stay connected to our updates, find us on LinkedIn. So just search Mighty Hum or search Russell McLeod. Follow me, connect with me. I would love to hear from you. And I'm always looking for more hairy, audacious projects to work on.
All right. Well, that does it for today's episode. We really enjoyed this conversation. As always, we hope you did too. If you have any questions for Al or myself, please feel free to give us a call or by joining the conversation on LinkedIn. And as we've seen here, success leaves clues, my friends. We'll see you next time.